pick up. And sound waves have to do with the fact that the dynamics of the giant gravitons are in fact given by one-dimensional bosons in the context of half BPS configurations. And these one-dimensional bosons are indeed bosonization of one-dimensional Fermi gas, which is what Tomonaga started thinking about in the 1950s. And it's indeed, while doing this work on giant gravitons, we also found that one-dimensional fermions, free fermions in an external potential can indeed be exactly bosonized by using some of the things that we learned in this context of giant gravitons. And I'll tell you a bit about that too. So these are some papers that the talk will be based on. So I'll give you a brief motivation. So basically, in the study of black holes, you know, these days there are a number of derivations of the entropy formula, the original entropy formula, let's say the B1, B5 system and various other black hole systems. So there is a certain entropy formula, the Lichtenstein entropy, and you have either a boundary theory or some description in terms of wrapped D brains and M brains and things, and at the end of the day you seem to get the right entropy formula all the time. Many of the derivations do not quite address the issue of where the degrees of freedom are. For example, the issue of whether the degrees of freedom are located at the horizon, or as Samir Martin would say, they are starting from the core of the black hole all the way to the horizon and so on. And there's one issue of the location of the degrees of freedom, where they are localized, if they are localized at all, and the other issue is what those degrees of freedom are. Okay. So that's in the context of black holes, but you can think of less complicated situations, some well-defined class of geometries, and you can ask where and what the degrees of freedom are. So of course, there is an exact, in cases where you can apply ABS CFT, there is an exact CFT description of the of the quantum mechanical degrees of freedom of the system and so on. But you would like to find configurations for degrees of freedom in the bulk, which explain the degrees of freedom of gravity. The naivest possible description of gravity would have been that these are like a whole bunch of gravitons. Okay. G mu plus H mu, and you put in lots and lots of gravitons, and the condensation of those gravitons, a mean field of those gravitons would give rise to a light gravitational configuration, the metric, the metric changes, and so on. Of course, we will compare the performance of gravitons in order to describe gravity, in describing gravity, with some other objects. Okay, so as we very well expect, for gravitons which have large energies, okay, the perturbative description of the gravity takes time. But are there other objects which perform better, and whether they also address the question of localization of the degrees of freedom? So we'll find that at least in the class of configurations that we will consider here, there are wrapped P brains which perform better, and they provide a better description of gravity in the sense that they're three-point function. So the three-point function of the gravitons that blows up, but the three-point function of the giant gravitons, they do not grow up. Give you one example of the better performance of the giant gravitons, which are wrapped D brains. I'll explain what giant gravitons are. And also they are localized So in the they're localized in the place where you expect them to be. So in most of the talk, I will consider supersymmetric situations which are less complicated than black holes. But towards the end, I'll touch on some recent result that we got in D1, D5, and we'll show that the degrees of freedom are localized exactly at the horizon. Okay, so it's easiest to describe the setting by starting to talk about half-VTS configurations. And so I'll talk about the half-VTS configurations in ADS 5.6.5 in three different ways. One is that I'll talk about gravitons, or giant gravitons, or dual giant gravitons. These will all be described as probe configurations, which propagate, which move around in a fixed background geometry. Okay, and I don't take into account back reactions. Okay, so that's one description. So this is the bulk description number one, if you like. Then, in the half VTS case, the fully back reactive geometries, okay, when such probe configurations are placed in the ADS 5.6.5 geometry, the back reactive geometries, that the full class of half VTS geometries is known. It was found by Lin and Avicenna. And the LLM solutions, and I'll describe quantization of these objects, the semi-classical quantization of these objects. I'll describe the quantization of these objects, the geometries, by using the method of collective coordinate quantization. In this case, there's a special symmetry group called W infinity which is involved, and using that and the method called the Kirilov's method of quadrature orbits, you can quantize these geometries as well, and of course. Yeah, and then I'll show that although the back reactions were ignored here, the full quantum mechanics, the quantum mechanical spectrum of this system is obtained from this system. Okay, this is something it works. Okay, we don't have a very incisive understanding of why it works, but it works. And then I will go to the third description, that's of course the boundary theory, and so we'll show that the boundary story, which in the half-VTS case corresponds to fermions, free fermions, that is equivalent to either of the two under this bosonization, which involves the bosonization, I mean the sound waves of one-dimensional metals. Okay, and so this method can be generalized to other situations, less supersymmetric situations, like involving four supersymmetries, four and above. So this is four supersymmetries, 1/8 and 32, which is four. And VTS configurations in which the probe configurations do not move around in ADS 5 plus S5, but in which the S5 is replaced by some less supersymmetric object called the Sasaki-Einstein manifold, and there are examples we studied involving ADS 5 plus Y5 and also ADS 4 plus Y7, and the same techniques and the same results go through, and finally I'll talk about D1 D5 in as much detail as would be permitted by time. Okay, so let me talk about half VTS configurations in ADS 5 plus S5 metric. So this is my cartoon of ADS 5. So the ADS 5 metric are right in global coordinates, in which there is a non-compact coordinate row, which goes from 0 to infinity, like this. And so this is the picture of some constant T section. So I have the row, and I have this S3 here. This is a three-dimensional sphere, so that's this guy. Okay. And then at each point of ADS 5, I have this S5, which I have written here as fibers, as a fiber product of S3 and the hemisphere. Okay. So you can think of that as, so this S3 is that d omega tilde square sitting here. And theta and phi, if you look at the parameter range of this, they actually correspond to a hemisphere. That's important. And of course, the radius of this S3 is warped, it depends on this theta, and that is why it's not a direct product, it's only a fiber product. But this picturization would be useful right now. So let me first give you one slide summary of gravitons in space-time. These were found out by Keane, Romanson, and Companion Hazen many years back, 1985, and also Gunadin and Marcus. And this is how they are. They have, so I should say that the half-meters configurations, they preserve the following symmetry, okay. So you see the S5 has some SO6 symmetry, and ADS5 has some SO4,2 symmetry. So half-meters configurations preserve SO4 out of this SO6, which basically leaves this sphere invariant. It doesn't touch it. Okay, and in this ADS5 also there is an S3 sitting there, and the symmetry that I would like to keep is the SO4 symmetry of that S3. So the rotational symmetry around these angles and the rotational symmetry around these angles will be the symmetries.
Do you care with proofs that all FDPS configurations are SO4 process of 20 grams?
Okay, so if I also specify which 16 supersymmetries I want to preserve, then this is all that there. And I'll specify which 16 supersymmetries I'm talking about.
But we don't have a general proof, so there are no other.
No, in fact, there could be other half-meters configurations. Some configurations.
Okay, so they are mutually.
Yeah.
Yeah, they break more supersymmetries.
No, you can have 16. In fact,
you can have half, but have different global
symmetries. But in those and these ones, I cannot, for example, quantize consistently because those and these will break different parts.
No, but so you can have things in which that and the other one preserves a quarter.
So a lower number, so you don't have half. But I'll explain to you which 16 supersymmetries I'm preserving here. So because of these symmetries, the gravitons, they have basically only one kind of motion. That's this thing that they each graviton rotates, okay, along some latitude of this hemisphere, okay. And the energy is equal to, the angular momentum. So that's in fact the BPS condition in this case. And the only thing that I would like you to get from this, remember from this transparency, is that there is a localization. I mean, so of course, you know, a rotating particle, it has this part of the wave function, that's clear. Phi is that angle of the latitude, and this is time. However, there is a localized, there is a wave function multiplying this thing, and that is localized. So in principle, you could say that, well, this is the energy of the system, and these are the particles which are causing this energy of the system, and this is where they are, because it's a localized wave function. You could do this. However, you can't go very far, because, you know, when you talk about large energy. So there are two reasons why if the graviton description breaks down. One is that the group theory of the system, as you can see from the, as I will explain when I go to the boundary theory, has a limit to this angular momentum. Okay, but the graviton, just the linearized wave equation, okay, does not give you that limit. N has, little n has a cutoff given by the capital N, which is the rank of the gauge group in terms of the boundary theory, or which is the given by the radius of curvature of ADS from the point of view of the bulb. Okay, so that exclusion principle is missing from the graviton thing. Furthermore, for large energies, even way before you reach that capital N limit, okay, when you reach the level of square root of N, okay, the correlation functions break down. Okay, the three-point function of these guys start breaking down. Okay, so that's all I have to say about gravitons. I can say more in person. Anybody wants to ask me later on? So now let's come to D-brain configuration, brain configurations, and let's see how they do. And so I'll consider giant gravitons. Let me define them for you. So these are D3 brains which wrap the S3 part of the S5. Okay? And the center of mass of the D3 brain that moves like this, pretty much like the graviton. Okay? And I'll come to the dynamics in a moment. What else? And they say, so they wrap the S3, and the center of mass is also at the center of ADS, at the point rho equal to 0. Okay, so that's the description of the giant.
Which engine is the graviton? Is it spin-through? Or is
it? Okay, it's called the graviton because the rest mass of the D-brain, okay, is cancelled completely. Okay. Against the round fluxes. If you look at the energetics of this thing, the rest mass cancels completely, and it has a spectrum exactly that energy equal to angular momentum starting from zero.
But why is it not a scalar or a vector? Or which is it a spin to?
Well, in this case, what happens is that it has exactly the same quantum number. It's not a spin 2 object, of course, in the strict sense of the term. These are gravitons in the 10 dimensional sense. Okay. So they have certain quantum numbers in terms of this SO4, 2 cross SO6 classification. And these guys have exactly the same quantum numbers.
But the part is that these guys are communist per symmetry multiplet, in which in that multiplet there is someone that. I mean, from the gate point of view, it's more clear that the scalar.
Yeah.
But this guy is the lowest component of a multiplet that has operators of higher scale, in particular.
I mean, if you look at the lowest component, okay, of the graviton multiplet of this of the one yeah. that I yeah okay so maybe there is a so you're saying there is a difference in the supersymmetry multiplet
no, there is a supersymmetry multiplet but the lowest component is the scalar.
Before you talked about these Kaluza Klein gravitons, they were just Kaluza Klein models of the high dimensional graviton, right?
So yeah, that's right.
So I think the point is that if you look at that 10 dimensional graviton and you do Kaluza Klein reductions, there will be scalar parts mm-hmm. of the high dimensional graviton. Those scalar modes have charges under SO4 cross SO4, and it turns out that those graviton brains probably have exactly the same
yeah.
charges.
They have, yeah, I mean,
he was talking about it as a scalar.
Yeah,
he was not talking about polarization. No.
Yeah, I mean, these involve some, the compact components of some combination of, in fact, gravitons as well as the, the four-form flux. So there is a, the four-form round number potential. So it's a mixture of the graviton and the four-form Raman-Raman potential, the compact components of them. And so that has certain transmission properties under SO4 cross 2 cross SO6. And these D3 brain giant gravitons have exactly the same transmission. I mean, this is...
The name graviton is a bit misleading then. Because it's a scalar, or as you
said, it's really... Oh, but the scalar under the ADS-5, it's not the scalar under the 10 dimensional.
Yeah,
this is
the
scalar.
So the spin 2 in the S5.
No. Yeah, these are gravitons in the 10 dimension. These are 10 dimensional gravitons. That's why they're called gravitons. But when you, you know, if you want to consider them as some gauge supergravity in AGS 5, in which the S5 has been integrated out, then they do not correspond to, you know, gravitons. I mean, they just correspond to scalars, I think, completely. Yeah. So from the point of view of AGS 5 gravity, they would correspond to scalars. Yes. So that remark becomes relevant for the 1/8 VPS situation, but here there is no such thing. The fermionic zero mode configuration, I mean the fermionic zero mode simply quantizes them. Okay, you don't remain in half VPS. So that's for the 1/8 VPS, it is true that the you know this system becomes a three-dimensional simple harmonic oscillator which describes the bosons, and there's a two-dimensional simple harmonic oscillator which describes the fermions.
So you're saying I cannot think about the spin 2 of the giant breakdown as coming from quantizing the fermionic zero mode, a linear on the brain?
No, I think the spin 2 is a bit of a, you know, it's a misleading thing. I mean, it was a spin 2 object in the 10-dimensional gravity. And I'm not insisting that you know these are like gravitons, you know, spin 2 like gravitons in the AGS 5. That's not important. That's not the important part.
But how do you see it as spin 2 from the conventional
one? Oh, that is what Kim Provence van Nieuwenhuizen did. I mean, you look at the you know linearized equation that gravitons and you know three-form fluxes they satisfy. I mean, you linearize R mu equal to zero, you know, whatever R mu equal to T mu nu, and similarly B mu F mu equal to blah blah. So you look at the equation of motion of the full 2B theory, okay, in the background of AGS 5 plus S5, and then you look at the you know spectrum of various modes. So these modes correspond to compact components, okay, the Kalmuczyk-Klein
component. This guy is a component of per-symmetry model. This happy VPS operators. Feeding some short multiplet from algebra. So if I give you an object, which is the lowest component, I can construct a full tower reactor with broken generators. That's interesting.
Yes.
Like trace that to the J, the gate theory, which is the lowest component of some short multiplet.
But for the precisely for the half VPS, okay, if you apply the supersymmetry raising operators, then you.
But they're descending the VPS, I don't VPS that they're descending.
Yeah. As far as I know, that story remains the same as for graviton and giant gravity. As far as I the okay, I can get back to you on this one. I think that there's no distinction between the giant graviton and the graviton, even in that respect, which is the supersymmetry. Because basically, I'll tell you in the boundary theory description of these guys. These are the you know the gravitons will correspond to singly trace operators of Z, okay, this third complex scalar, and these guys will correspond to the Schur polynomials of Z. So they are just you know linear combinational basis elements, and I know that you know if you look at the like fermion zero modes. Now let me get back to this. I'll come to this in a moment. Okay. So you have to put in some conditions on these the motion of these guys So how are they described? These guys are described by, you know, Dirac von Impelled, action plus Jefferson, etc. In the back ABS file, which cross S5 down geometry and flux. And you have to put in the half weakness condition. So the half weakness condition in this case says that, so let's say, you know, theta and phi are the two dynamical variables of this theory. Theta is here and phi goes like this. Then it's theta phi, p theta, p phi. These were the four phase space coordinates to begin with. And you have half weakness condition, which is p theta equal to 0 and p phi equal to sine square theta. Okay? So you can check that these are the conditions which satisfy the Kappa symmetry injection. So then the point is that you treat the half Nepias conditions as Dirac constraints of the theory. Okay. So the supersymmetric constraints you think of as Dirac constraints. And therefore the four-dimensional phase space gets reduced to a two-dimensional reduced phase space. And in fact, theta and phi, which of course had zero Poisson bracket to begin with, okay, develop a non-zero Dirac bracket. Okay. So theta and phi become a non-commutative, they become a phase space, and the Dirac bracket is given by this thing. And you can make a map from theta phi to some x1, x2, which maps the hemisphere to unit disk, and this Dirac bracket becomes a Cartesian Dirac bracket, which says that the dynamical, the initial configuration space, which was a hemisphere, that gets mapped to a unit disk, which is a phase space now. It's a non-commutative unit disk. And once you realize that, you can go back to the, okay, so I have not, so here it is. The BPS condition again is the same. The energy is given by the angular momentum. But the angular momentum, the p phi, which was sine square theta, remember? So p phi was sine square theta. And because of these relations, sine square theta is the same as x1 square plus x2 square. So the Hamiltonian becomes x square, x1 square plus x2 square, where x1, x2 has a commutative bracket between them. So this is, of course, a simple harmonic oscillator. And it has a linear spectrum, just like the graviton. But now it has an interesting thing, is that the phase space is not a plane, it's a unit disk. Okay? So a disk can only have a finite number of Bohr orbits. Okay? Because it has a finite extent. So that is why if you do this geometric quantization, look at any standard book of geometric quantization, then the disk has this truncated, this is the interpretation of it gets quantized with a truncated simple harmonic oscillator. Okay, in which the truncation comes, the finite n effect comes automatically in this thing because of this one. So the stringy exclusion principle we have recovered, okay, in the Jack graviton viewpoint. And we will.
So, strictly speaking, it's maybe a bit tricky because you don't have x1, x2 equal 1 in the finite dimension of the Hilbert space, right? If you take the trace, maybe you don't worry about that.
No. Yeah, so that I allow, of course, just in the Heisenberg group, I do allow. No, so x1 and x2, of course, cannot be finite dimensional matrices. So the.
Your exclusion principle is that they should be.
That's right. So you. So, yeah, so that I can describe how to do that. In fact, this, how to describe how to quantize the unit disk, you have to go to the Stoft operators, okay, yeah, which.
So you can go to the finite operator, but then the Hamiltonian operator is not really.
So there is a certain projection. There is a certain projection that people do, okay, from the original Hilbert space using the projection operator, which truncates into the first n levels, and then you can look at the shape of the resulting phase space, and that corresponds to a disk. Actually, this is some work. I can describe that. So this is done with the help of a projection operator on the standard Heisenberg valid geometric quantization. Okay, so you get the stringy exclusion principle business, and I'll show you later on in a few slides that the their three-point function also is well behaved. Okay, so now there can be other kinds of half-weakness configurations, which are called dual jam graviton. which do the following. These are again V3 mains, but they wrap the free sphere of ADS5, and the phase space has two kinds of possible motions. At least this is the generalization that we would do. And in the case of one HVPS, actually, we will do the most general thing. But for now, let us allow motion like this, okay, and like this one. So this motion, of course, would be fixed because of VPS condition. So if you take the, you know, the configuration space to be so this is how you know, dual jams are described. So there is one dynamic variable, which is this phi, and then this radius rho. So rho phi, p rho p phi is a four-dimensional phase space. You do the half VPS conditions, which is that p rho equal to 0 and p phi equal to sine square rho now. And you do a similar thing, you know, treat the supersymmetry conditions at Dirac constraints, make a map from the rho phi coordinates to x1, x2, but this time you don't get a disk, you get a full plane because rho to begin with was a non-compact variable. Okay? So that sin square rho is now a semi-infinite line, and that is the radius of this plane. And again you get the same this thing. And this time the Hamiltonian, which was p phi, and that was equal to sin square rho, becomes x1 x square plus x2 square again. And however, since this is a plane, this quantum number goes from 0 to infinity. Okay? But still, you get a stringy exclusion principle from a different point of view. So you see, we are talking about one jump graviton or one dual jump graviton so far. Okay? In case of the dual jump graviton, it turns out that the number of dual jump gravitons, okay, is finite. Okay, so the stringy exclusion principle comes from there. Why? Because roughly speaking, it is like this, that if you have one dual giant graviton here wrapping this thing, then the flux here and the flux here, they differ by one. Okay, so if the flux here is n, this here is n minus one. Okay, so if you begin at infinity with n, okay, you can have at best n number of dual giant gravitons. Okay. So that is why the number of dual jump gravitons is limited by n. This is how the string exclusion principle comes about. Okay, so that's what I have said. Of course, you know, in all this thing, you don't expect this argument to hold water, because if you say that, you know, it's n here and n minus 1 here, that geometry is not ADS5 plus X5. I am talking about change of flux across this thing. So I am talking about back reaction. So when I have a number of p-grains which is compatible to n, okay, this argument should not work. Okay? But it works in retrospect when we compute the semi-classical composition and compute the partition function with no limit on energy levels, but the total number of particles as n, we get exactly the quantum, the partition function, as you get from the boundary theory, which of course is the test for everything.
So does it bound on the density of energy, or?
It's the bound on the total number of particles. Yeah. So, and in the case of the giant graviton description, it's the bound on.
If you really go to the nonlinear description, you take into account back reaction.
Yeah.
You don't expect a coupling between the energy and the total number, so it doesn't couple. Still, the bound just on the total number.
Well, in so when I you know, look at the, let's say, the boundary description, which is always the exact description, there it comes in a completely different version. These are not bosons at all. They turn out to have fermion descriptions. So there are two kinds of bosonizations which are available of that fermionic description in the boundary. One description gives me a limit on the total number of bosons. The other bosonization gives me a limit on the energy of maximum energy of each one particle, each boson. Okay, and both bosonizations are available. Both are exact bosonizations, which we have described in one of our papers. Okay, so now let me get to the half VPS geometries. So these are the. So this is like you know, the kind of binorial notation that we use for the 10-dimensional Clifford algebra. So using that sort of representation, the full set of spinners will be given by plus minus half, plus minus half, plus minus half, plus minus half. Okay, but the last spinner, I say, that is plus half only, and I allow minus half to be broken. Okay, so I well, this is this is too fast, perhaps. But you know, you can look at the you can set up a notation for the supersymmetry charges of the ABS process 5 geometry exactly like you would have done in 10-dimensional space, I mean flat space, and so these are the supersymmetry that I preserve here, and these are explained in various places. In particular, there is a review by Shiraz Nirwala in a group theory, not a review, it's a paper by him, which is very good in explaining this fact. Okay, so, right, so now the geometries, okay, so now this is the second description which talks about the geometries, okay, fully bathymetric geometries, and LLM. In 2004, found the full class of geometries which satisfy these supersymmetries, geometries as well as the Raman-Raman field, which I have not written here. But yeah, so it's some complicated thing. But let me make two remarks here: is that there is a so under the you know symmetries, the SO4 cross SO4 symmetries. There has to be two S3 parts. Okay, so here are the two S3 parts. In case of the ABS5 plus S5 background, this S3 part is part of S5, and this S3 part is part of ABS5. Of course, for the general geometry, the ABS5 plus S5 structure is all gone, but these two spheres remain. And besides these two spheres, which are six coordinates, you have four more coordinates: x1, x2, y, and t. Okay. And in fact, this metric, the full class of metrics, is given only by one function, which is the function of x1, x2, and y. So that's this function. Furthermore, the y dependence of this function is also given by its data on the y equal to 0 plane. Okay, so that's the story of the LLM metric. So in very short, and the only thing that I would like you to note from here is that at y equal to 0, there could be possible problems because the radii of both of these spheres seems to vanish. Okay, so that's a very, very singular geometry. Okay. However, you can avoid that singularity by letting u go to 0 or 1 at the y equal to 0 plane. Okay, so let me not describe that, how that happens, but you can see that there's a possibility of a 0 by 0. If you at y equal to 0, you also let u go to 0 or u go to 1. Okay? And it indeed happens that way. So you get, therefore, a droplet picture. The data of any of the LLM geometries is given by the fact that there is a function in the x1, x2 plane, okay, which can be either 0 or 1. So you can say these are the regions. These are the regions in which u is equal to 1, and the white regions are something in which u is equal to 0. So you have a droplet representation of any of the LLM matrix. So that's what it is. Okay. And now it is, you know, you can, so this is something that you can do is to treat this u variable as a collective coordinate. And notice that there is a group of area-preserving diffeomorphisms that obviously keeps this configuration space closed. You know, it maps one configuration to another configuration, because if you make an area preserving diffeomorphism, then this is the u equal to 0 or 1 condition. Then, of course, this condition is preserved, and this condition is also preserved.
So, condition u square equal to u is what?
The condition u square equal to u is the same as u is either 0 or 1.
Yeah. So, is the condition to have a giant vector?
Is the condition to have a regular metric? Okay, so, yeah. So this metric would typically be singular at y equal to 0 plane, unless you have u equal to 0 or 1 at the y equal to 0 plane. Okay? So therefore, the y equal to 0 plane, okay, has the value of u either 0 or 1. That's the same condition in this one. And since these are local conditions, if you make a canonical transformation, so area preserving diffeomorphism is like a canonical transformation of the two-dimensional phase space, okay, like that. And so this is that's another interesting condition here. Well, it should be n if I normalize. So there is also there is one condition that's a regularity condition, and then there's also an integral condition that says that the total area of the black regions, okay, should be equal to n, because you can show by simple Gauss law calculation that the flux at infinity of the Ramondorf flux, which is n, becomes equal to the area of the black regions. Okay, so that also is another condition. And so therefore, there is obviously a group of symplectic transformations, a group of area preserving diffeomorphisms that acts on this configuration space. Then you can use some method called the Kirilov method, which I cannot get into, and you get some collective coordinate action. And if you have worked on such things in the C equal to 1 matrix model days, okay, you would encounter exactly this sort of action, which corresponds to the semi-classical limit of free fermions. It's very easy to, it's very difficult to figure out that this corresponds to the semi-classical limit of free fermions, but I can describe that in private, how that works out. So if you start from the fermion, so here it comes like this. So you want to quantize these geometries. Okay, how do you do that? Okay. So think of soliton quantization. Suppose you have a class of solitons given by their center of mass, size, etc., etc., separations, and so on. So you can take those zero modes of the multi-monopole configuration, let's say, and try to quantize them. Okay, so you get some quantum mechanics of those things. Here, the idea is that this u, okay, is instead of a parameter, okay, it's one function of x1 and x2, which is like the corrective coordinate.
But here, the coordinates don't commute. It's not like the configuration space.
That is very important. Indeed, that is the reason why. So this u space, okay, is actually a phase space. Okay. Okay. So that you can take into account. Okay. In fact, precisely this Kirilov quadrant orbit method allows you to do that.
But I mean, you quantize it. So the discretization does it come from a general quantization scheme?
So the Kirilov constant quantization scheme.
No, okay. I'm saying you're quantizing your particular set, particular solution.
Yeah.
But
so
where is that? You can on this phase space, you get nothing in this object in the phase space.
So there are two. So there are two other ways of arriving at the same action. One is that you can represent this, the black and white regions in terms of pixels, okay, in terms of arbitrary number of holes and particles, okay, and those holes you represent in terms of giant gravitons and the particles in terms of dual giant gravitons, and you write the combined Dirac-Bohn infrared action for all of them, assuming that they're non-overlapping. Okay. If they're overlapping, of course, you cannot do that. That procedure doesn't make sense. You add the Dirac-Bohn infrared actions, and then that action becomes exactly the same as the Kirilov constant action. There is another method which is called the CWZ. Witten, Zuckerman, and I forget the C. So there's another method of given a certain BPS class of configuration, given a certain subset of motions okay, equations of motion. Just from that fact, you can quantize the theory. Okay, there you can derive this symplectic current, and so the basic, you know, this thing is to get the symplectic current. So here I got the symplectic current by using this W infinity symmetry. Okay, but even without a symmetry, you can do that. Okay, and you get exactly the same action. Okay, so unfortunately, you know, I'm going through these things in sort of not in great detail because of lack of time, but I can explain these things later on.
Is the W symmetry coming from, I mean, in the more general theory? Does it have an interpretation? Or?
In the more general theory, for example, if you go to 1/4 BPS or 1/8 BPS or no supersymmetry at all, then there is nothing like a W infinity symmetry. Okay.
It is just an accidental symmetry of certain subsets.
That's right. It is an accidental symmetry here, but you can use this to get the correct action. But in the more general case, presumably you can use the CWZ framework to get this thing. But that has also not been done. However, you know, in the more general case, anyway, well, beyond half because anyway, you don't even know the geometries. Nobody has found the counterpart of the LLM geometries for 1/4 BPS and 1/8 BPS and so on. So this exercise has not been done for good reasons because the geometries are not known. You know, for example, even the data. So here, for example, data is one function of two variables. So in the case of 1/4 BPS or 1/8 BPS, even the data is not known. Okay.
Yeah. Can I think about that as some type of mini superspace quantization of the origin of
the Yes, it is, that's right. So this is exactly like what the, you know, the condensator people or the field theory people would say, call collective coordinate quantization or the, you know, the moduli space quantization, but, you know, the gravity people might call it mini superspace quantization and so on.
But so it's not exactly modular, right? Because the energy of different droplet configurations is different in the fluid. The mass state of the n dimensional geometry would be different.
So it is like okay, so the Hamiltonian is in fact in this field of quantization, Hamiltonian is just one of the generators which does not commute with everything. Okay. Hamiltonian is not all droplets need not have the same energy. In order to derive this part, which is the symplectic current, okay, you might even drop the Hamiltonian part. In which case, all of them indeed have the same energy. Energy is not the important configuration. But
I guess my question was, in which context I can think about you as being modular?
Okay.
Space for what?
So it is this thing that all the U's, okay, are solutions of any constant U of x1, x2 is a solution of the Killing-Spinner equations. Mm-hmm. That is the context. It is true, however, that all U's do not have the same energy. So it is not a zero mode of the energy variable, okay, but it's in a sense it's like zero mode of the action. The equations of motion are invariant under change of U from one U to another.
So those are just parameters of the solution.
That's right. But you can do a quantization, even then you can do a quantization. Okay. Such quantization methods are available. So in the original works of Tom Willis and Jervin Sahita and so on, but you can also do it using the CWZ framework. If you have solutions of equation of motion, you can practice. Okay, so I don't know how I'm doing with time. Oops. So I'll go through this thing fast. Okay, so now, so this is what I said, that this is the semi-classical limit of the second quantization for any free functions in a harmonic oscillator. And in fact, this U gets identified from that point of view as a Schneider fermion phase space density. So what I'm saying is the following, that you can start from free fermions in a simple harmonic oscillator and introduce this U as something called the Wigner phase space distribution and write down an action for the U. Okay? So this becomes that action. So this is how you can recognize.
What do you mean by UXTS?
So what I have done here is that first I say that, well, the solutions of the equation of motion were given by just U of X, which is X1 and X2. I promote them, as in the case of mini superspace or the modular space transformation, I promote them to a function of T. Okay. But there is a term which is called the cap term, okay, which cannot be written locally. Okay. For that, I need another variable. I need to introduce another variable, just like the Weissmann-Witten term of the Cayley-Lagrangian. Okay, so that's the other variable. Yes. Okay, good. So this is the thing, that the same Kirilov action can be reproduced by Dirac Bonnefeld plus Jean Simons by interpreting the arbitrary U configuration in terms of an assembly of Jahn gravitons and dual Jahn gravitons, but they have to be non-overlapping Jahn gravitons. And if you do things correctly, you will see that in fact, the fermions cannot be put on top of each other, okay? But the giant gravitons, of course, can be put on top of each other. So if you do this thing with overlapping giant gravitons, then you have to bosonize the then free fermions action, and it becomes equal to the giant gravitons under bosonization, okay? Which is an exact map, of course. So now the story of the boundary. So this is what the half-Lucas sector looks like. It's very simple. Okay, remember that the n equals 4 super Youngmans theory has 6 scalars, and I can form 3 complex scalars out of them. So it involves only one complex scalar like this, and there is an action which describes them, and that's given by z dot square minus z square. This term comes from the coupling to the curvature of the S3. And this behaves like n fermions in a simple harmonic oscillator potential. And you have fermions, but you can. So first of all, observe that the simple harmonic oscillator, all the operators in this theory, which can be written in terms of fermion bilinears, okay, can alternatively be written in terms of these guys like this, or products of single trace operators, or it can be written in terms of some other linear combination of single trace operators called the Schur polynomials, corresponding to either the completely symmetric completely symmetric representation that corresponds to the dual giant gravitons, or completely anti-symmetric representation that corresponds to giant gravitons. Think of these as some linear combination of single trace operators, like this thing, the Schur polynomial corresponding to this one, okay, is just trace of z square minus trace of z square. And this guy plus trace of this, okay, like this. And so of course, all of these guys can be written in terms of these eigenvalues. Okay, so the eigenvalues of these matrices correspond to fermions. So either these guys or these guys can all be written in terms of the fermion bilinear operators. And in order to show that the theory of this theory corresponds to the giant graviton or the dual giant graviton theory, you have to use these bosonization techniques, and you get an exact equality. Let me just talk about high energy behavior of the giant gravitons, which I have been talking about for a while. Is that if you look at the three-point function of gravitons at very high energies using the boundary map, you find that the three-point function blows up even for energies which are of the order of and more than square root of n, and for in fact energy of order n, it blows up exponentially. So that's very bad behavior in terms of three-point functions. For giant gravitons, you can use this boundary map, okay, and compute the 3-point function and find that the 3-point function, in fact, very well behaved. It, in fact, decays essentially. So it's almost free. Okay. In fact, there is indeed a map. If you really look at the original, you know, phonons of the one-dimensional, the original particle of the one-dimensional fermions, okay, you will find that there are free fermions, okay, in a simple harmonic oscillator, get bosonized, free bosons in a simple harmonic oscillator. It is the property only of simple harmonic oscillator. It doesn't happen for inverted simple harmonic oscillator. That's an interacting boson. Okay, so in fact, you can have another basis in which this gamma 3 will get zero.
So can, is there an interpolation? I mean, you show that if you have one giant plasma zone,
yeah,
there's maximum energy.
Yeah.
So now, when you try to put two together, you know, so the question is, how can you give an interpolation of that, that, you know, what is the sort of addition of momentum when I try to have two giant gravitons?
Yeah.
And
so if you have two giant gravitons, then there is no.
Yeah, but you might try to fuse them together as you're trying in the 3-point function.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Yeah.
So the theory in order to be consistent should prevent this
that's
fused object to have.
That's a very good.
Which is higher than the yeah. maximum scale you have there.
Yeah, yeah. Right? So that is taken into account indeed. So such giant gravitons then can only be interpreted not as a single giant graviton, but at, as a sort of jet of giant gravitons. It is true.
You that's very reminiscent of, okay, other places
okay.
where something is like
I see. Right. No, that's a very important, this interpretation actually took us some time to figure out.
The question is, suppose you are trying to describe the fit theory of this giant graviton.
Yeah.
The second quantized version.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the second quantized version has to be taken in, has to take into account this exclusion principle very correctly.
Has it been done?
Yeah. So it does not actually become a field theory if you really try to do correctly. It becomes a lattice field theory. And in fact, the fact that when two jam gravitons hit each other, the third guy, if it is to be a single particle, cannot exceed a certain this thing. It corresponds to, you know, there being necessarily a lattice structure to the gravity. So I can, I'm running out of time. So can I take 5 more minutes? Yeah. Okay. Right, hopefully. Right, good. So now, okay, the same story. What is it that I said so far is the following, that there are three descriptions of gravity in the half VPS case. There are three descriptions of gravity in the half VPS case. So one is geometry. So this is LLM. Another is probe configurations. So that's giant graviton or dual giant graviton. And there is boundary theory. Okay, so in the half VPS case, these were fermions in a simple harmonic oscillator. These were bosons in a simple harmonic oscillator. They were related by bosonization. By the way, as a byproduct of this considerations, we found that indeed fermions in an arbitrary potential, non-relativistic, finite number of non-relativistic potentials in an arbitrary potential can be bosonized. This was a bosonization program which Tomonaga had started a long time back. He, of course, his bosonization, of course, is, although it's approximate, it's very elegant. Okay, it's, and that's what corresponds to Goldman-Mandelstam bosonization. Later on, the bosonization that we have, okay, it we can recover, of course, that approximate regime in which the fermions are all close to the Fermi surface. But even if the fermions are far below the Fermi surface, we can treat that, and that corresponds to a Godoffel Hamiltonian usually. Okay. Except that in the same case of simple harmonic oscillator, this corresponds to simple harmonic, so free bosons, so free fermions in a simple harmonic oscillator corresponds to free bosons in a simple harmonic oscillator again. But if it is a nonlinear spectrum, then this corresponds to interactions in case of bosons. So that's some very nice story in this one. And we saw that the LLM directly corresponds to fermion. Okay, by this semi-classical correspondence, the collective coordinate quantization here corresponds to that, and these fermions, and you know, so this was the collective coordinate quantization, and so there's a circle that was completed here. In case of other things like 1/8, and in between, there's 1/4 PPS. Also, this story is known, and this story is known, and all I can say is that this story is not known, okay? And this is not a fermion thing here, but it corresponds to looking at all three complex scalars for 1/8 BPS. You can compute the partitioning function of this quantity, which has been done by other people, and we have computed the partition function of this one using dual giant gravitons, and that's the story here. Is that you have, you know, when is a system of dual giant gravitons 1/8 BPS? Is that when the various different dual giant gravitons wrap these S3s and the rotations of the center of mass, okay, are not parallel to each other, okay? So then if the orbits rotate in all possible equatorial planes of S5, then in fact in any plane of S5, then that corresponds to 1/8 BPS thing. So here the phase, the coordinate space is this direction as well as all of the S5 entities. That's the most general configuration under this class that you can have. And what happens is that this configuration space, which is S5 cross this half line, that can be now be mapped to a C3, okay, simplectically even, and the Hamiltonian becomes a three-dimensional simple harmonic oscillator. So it's like x1 squared plus x2 squared plus y1 squared plus y2 squared plus z1 squared plus z2 squared. And again, all the other things also work out.
Do you have a maximum energy again there?
So this is dual giant graviton, which had a maximum number of particles. So that maximum number of particles also comes through. For giant gravitons, the story is much more complicated because the place where they wrap and the place where they move, okay, get all meaning up. So for to treat them, you need you know, more heavy-duty machinery called the Michalov surfaces. These are treatments of holomorphic curves and so on. But this story also has been worked out by Shiraz and company.
But do you expect a maximum energy?
It's not a maximum energy there. It's a little more complicated thing. It's the maximum degree of a certain polynomial. That's what corresponds to. So. It's sort of like generalization of the concept of maximum energy, but it's not quite like that. So, but the dual giant gravitons story becomes exactly the same. And you can play this game for dual giants by replacing in geometries where you replace the S5 by Sasaki-Einstein manifolds, the same thing works. Again, the probe configuration gives you the same result as the boundary theory, wherever you can, wherever you do know the boundary theory. Okay, it's an amazing thing, but it works. Okay, so now you know, I'll go through the D1, D5 pretty fast. I'll just tell you a little puzzle here. Is that you might ask? Of course, you know, my final destination is D1, D5 because there's a black hole in this. Well, there's a black hole even in LDS5 process 5 in the 1/16th BPS sector. Okay. But that also people are, I mean, it's a very active area of research. People are trying very hard. But it appears that point like quantum mechanics may not be good enough to describe the 1/16th. In fact, even here, in the case of D1, D5, which has a BTZ black hole, okay, we are already finding that point like quantum mechanics, okay, would not be enough. Okay, you need at least a sigma model. Quantum mechanics of strings to describe this degree of freedom here. So there's a nice little puzzle here, okay, that already the boundary theory counting seems to say that, you know, the D1, D5 system is something in which you have the there's a D1 brain on a D5. So let's say I say this is the D5. Okay, cartoon here is the D2, and there's a D1 brain. So D5 and D1. And the boundary description is that the degrees of freedom are all here. Okay, in the in the relative transverse dimension. Basically, the degrees of freedom are on the brain. On the other hand, there is another claim of representing this degrees of freedom in terms of the Lunin-Mathur geometries and also by Lunin, Nelson, and Mills, which seems to say that the degrees of freedom are strings vibrating in the oscillator, strings oscillating in the transverse directions. So there's a little puzzle here, which is as if whether the degrees are these the degrees of freedom or are these the degrees of freedom. And this is similar to this, what I have called, the Callan-Nullesner spikes or the bions and so on, which, Joma here has recently also worked on. So it's as if the Higgs sector of a certain theory, the Higgs branch of a certain theory, and the Coulomb branch of a certain theory seem to describe the same degree of freedom. And the similar thing that also happens in terms of this spikes of Callan and Nagasena is that either you have this description of the spikes in terms of objects sticking out of the D-brain into the transverse space, or you in terms of the gauge field configurations on the brain. Okay, and so there are very precise sort of calculations in this in the context of Wilson lines by these gentlemen, and that makes me rather hopeful that one can presumably understand this thing in the context of ADS5 plus S5 and eventually for D1, D5. For D1, D5, I'll just make one statement that indeed it is not just point-like strings. Okay, so the role of the giant gravitons and the dual giant gravitons here are played by string-like objects, which are either D1 brains or RAC D5 brains. So therefore, however, the fluctuations of these objects are important, and they're given by functions of sigma. It's not just constants here. And we have found recently a sigma model which describes this stringy degrees of freedom, and that sigma model is given by some SL2 mod cross SU2 cross the conformal field theory of the symmetric product T4, and we find that for the number of D1 brains, when the number of D1 brains saturates the exclusion principle limit, then this sigma model is exactly the same as
right. Well. So this sigma model arises from the collective quantum quantization of D brains.
Okay. That's right. That's what, and so there are two interesting things that happen, is that this sigma model corresponds to, so there's a level k here. So when I look at q1, small q1 number of d1 brains, and the level is given by small q1 cascade q5. Okay, similar thing is true for cascade d5. And then there are exclusion principle limits, similarly to what we got for dual giant gravitons here. And the saturation limit, okay, in the saturation limit, interestingly, this level becomes exactly Q1, Q5, and that is the description of the boundary conformal field theory. Okay, so that that's one thing that's nice that happens. The other thing which I'm more excited by is that in these objects, you can look at first the constant modes in which these things are not functions of sigma. Okay, these are constant modes, again giant gravitons like configurations, but something a little more general than giant gravitons. Giant gravitons are sitting at the center of ADS, but here I allow them not to sit at the center of the ADS only, but there are other supersymmetric configurations which are away from the center. And in fact, they do more interesting things. Okay, so they rotate at some particular value of rho. And you can ask yourself, what is the stable, what is the size of a stable orbit? So the size of the stable orbit of this probe configurations, okay, so first of all, if there is a rotation like this, so there is this ABS3 now, and there is somebody who is rotating like this. In fact, it has a rotation also in the other thing, it's a combined rotation. You can ask yourself, well, and this rotation corresponds to a third charge. If you don't have any probe configuration, ABS3 plus S3 plus V4, that corresponds to a two charge system. It has Q1 and Q5, the number of D1 gives number of D5. Okay. That corresponds to so-called small black. Now I have a probe configuration that gives you a third charge. Okay. This corresponds to that third charge. Okay. So corresponding to a particular angular momentum, the centrifugal force fixes where in this rho direction you should be. You compute the size of the stable orbit, and you find that in fact, at least numerically agrees, whatever that means, numerically exactly agrees with the horizon size, okay, of a three charge fat BTG black. So this seems to, as if say, that a three charge BTG, yes. So there's a flux corresponding to the D1 brains, there's a flux corresponding to the D5 brains, okay. And then there's a third charge of the system that corresponds to So the BTZ black hole arises as the near horizon geometry of a three charge geometry, okay, in which the mass and the angular momentum and so on, they are given by a combination of the three charges. So that the statement is that the size of the stable orbit here, okay, corresponds to exactly the horizon size of a three charge black hole whose near horizon geometry is the BTZ black hole, and in fact can compute this, put the various ABS radii, string coupling constant, blah blah blah, etc., and you get exactly the same number for the thing. So, and in fact, this size, okay, you can not only do this in just the classical particle mechanics, but you can look at the, so here also again the dynamics becomes that of a simple harmonic oscillator. The center of mass of this object, okay, moves as it, like in a simple harmonic oscillator. So you can actually compute the wave function, and you can show that the wave function is actually peaked at this radius, okay, exactly like the nth Hermite function of a simple harmonic oscillator. It's peaked there, and so that seems to say that for a black hole perhaps, the horizon, the degrees of freedom are localized. Okay, so this is something. But of course, this picture in one shot does not give you the entropy, because I have ignored in this little calculation the sigma dependence of these things. Okay, so I should now put in the stringy fluctuations of these guys, okay, and try to reproduce the entropy. So that is something that can tell me in bulk, okay, where the degrees of freedom are perhaps situated. So that's. So I have already, so this gives us a mechanical model of the black hole horizon. Furthermore, the horizon, so this again, because of the, the BPS conditions, etc., becomes actually phase space. This direction and this direction actually do not commute. And this is something that many people have looked for, including myself, that if the horizon it was part of a non-commutative space, that would be a nice thing, because that would have an interpretation of the phase space cells. I mean, Bekenstein-Tuft cells as the phase space Heisenberg cells. Okay, so I have gone way over time. I have described three kinds of approaches to half BPS, two kinds of approaches to 1/8 BPS, and other less symmetric situations, and ultimately, I'm excited by this development in the BTZ black hole. So, thank you.
Any questions?
There's some applications you can do to throw something at the probe range.
Yeah. So that's of course a very good question. So this question relates to back reaction. So this is without back reaction. I've just found a numerical agreement. But the question that Johan is asking is the following: is that suppose I have a third charge object here, some second object carrying the third charge here, and what is the resulting geometry? So I need some test configuration here, okay, which is moving in the background of this and that, okay, and one can try to see perhaps whether the geometry has changed, at least towards something like a BTZ black hole. If so far we are far away from that one, so we are just trying to compute the entropy of this. By the way, I should say that this is with Shiraz and his student and one of the postdocs. So that would be a very interesting thing. Perhaps a third charge can probe the deformation of the geometry.
Any more questions? Yeah, let's thank the speaker again.